Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, your weekly dose of Porsche culture. With Tech Talk, Heritage, the Ren Builds playlists, along with a massive dollop of waffle, we'll keep you entertained. So subscribe now on any podcast streaming service and YouTube. Welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to another episode this week. Actually, two in 2 weeks is, I feel like I can leave the intro in now after saying last week I'll take it out. But this week, again, short intro because the episode is a long one again. This week I'm with Frank Cassidy. If you've watched any of the YouTube episodes, you'll know that this is one of the ones that went down an absolute storm. So I said to Frank after the last episode, who I speak to on a fairly regular basis now anyway, how do you fancy doing some more? But rather than being in a kind of conventional interview format or anything like that, anything that resembles an interview, and I shudder calling any of these things an interview, I said, well, why don't we just pick a topic and go for it and talk through the topic? So much more of a balanced conversation rather than me asking questions and then him answering or anything that resembles that. So what you're going to hear coming up is really just us talking about our experiences, about road trips. The benefit is of his vast experience about driving around Europe. Me, less so, but still very recent and kind of quite sort of varied, really. Everything from just me soloing around Europe to going away last year to the Nürburgring and meeting up with the Gold Leaf guys and all the touring stuff as well. So this episode is kind of ideally really tried to be something of a bit of a helping hand for those people that have considered it but not taken that step. So that's what this episode is going to be all about. The one thing I did say I was going to do, though, and I don't think I did it last week, or I definitely didn't do it last week, but I planned to, and that was to go through the list of places and dates that you'll be able to find me and come and say hello. Or if you want to come see the car, the Rengineering Cayman SE, then you can come and do that. So pretty straightforward then. So Bicester Scramble this April, I can't remember what the date is for that, but that's coming up in a week or so. Then you got the 17th of May, Legends Drivers Club in Stuttgart South. There's an event there, so we'll be at Stuttgart South. Big ups to Andre. 25th of May, Luft versus Wasser. The car's going to be a featured car there, which is cool. June, the 1st of June, Simply Porsche. And the 7th of June is one of my favourite events from last year, to the point I made a short video short on it, which is a Legends Drivers Club Hever Castle. Again, the Cayman will be a feature car for that. 21st of June, in between the 7th and the 21st, I'm going on holiday, so don't expect an episode then. But the 21st of June, Porsche Club Great Britain have asked me to be a couple of their, or a few of their events this year. That one's at Summer Solstice, which is at Boxing Gas, ironically. 29th of June, PCGB, so Porsche Club Great Britain again, at Brooklands. Interestingly, one of the first ever photos I took of my Cayman before I did any work on it was on the Brooklands Bank. The second day I had it, I drove to Brooklands and parked on the bank. So it's going to be a feature car again for that. July, the 5th of July, Flat 6 show. You'll find it in the ferry paddock. The 20th, Porsche in the Park. There's a discussion I'm having with the organisers about whether not so much me doing, because if you remember last year I did a two live episodes shot at Porsche in the Park. That's not going to happen this year, but I may well feature on someone else's podcast if they're, or someone else's video if they choose to do that. So that's possible, but I'll definitely be up for the event anyway. 3rd of August, classically, it's going to be based at Megaphonics, and that'll be with Michelin on the Michelin stand. 9th of August, back at Bicester again, and this is for the Piston Heads annual, and I'll be on the Michelin stand for that. September, October, I've blocked those out for shooting some content, so trying to queue up. I've got some episodes being shot over the next month or two anyway, but I'll try and find some more bits and pieces to do in that time as well, the September, October. Again, there's a good chance I'll go on holiday in October, so there may be a bit of a drop in content coming for there, but that's by the by. November, currently open, and then December, the 13th of December at Farnborough Airport for Porsche Club Great Britain as well, and the car will be a featured car there. So That all of that stuff is going to go on the website. I haven't updated it yet, but I will put all of those new dates on the website so you can go and have a look. And I'll post all of that stuff again at the Rengineering Podcast. That's the Instagram handle for the podcast. Or you can go and check out the car-specific stuff and the build-specific stuff at rengineering.uk. To call it there, because it is a big, long-ass episode. For those of you that are delicate with your emotions, if you hear swear words, this has got lots of swear words in, so if you've got little kiddies around as well listening, so I'll probably bear that in mind. But it's good content. There's some kind of real pearls of wisdom. Not so much for me necessarily, but Frank's got some pearls. Both of us talk about our personal experiences and both the highs and absolutely the lows, because inevitably with these big road trips, things go wrong at times. And as you'll hear from Frank, quite catastrophically. And it's lucky to be alive, actually, by the sounds of it. So yeah, all good stuff to come. And I'll catch you back up at the end. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. And not one episode's being shot today. Just finished Tut Hill and come straight here to see my old mate, Frank Cassidy. So got lots to catch up on. We're going to catch up on some of the stuff that's been happening this year for Frank, but also we're going to talk about road trips. It's something that it was. I had it as a thing to do until my Niners Unplugged episode. And then Frank said, where have you been with your car? And if you watch that episode, you can go into Niners Unplugged and you'll see it somewhere in that list. My answer was terrible. I basically turned around and said, oh, I've been to a couple of places in the UK, and it was completely insufficient. But off camera, we got talking about where I should go. And then within about a month, I'd booked Eurotunnel tickets and started planning a solo road trip around Europe, which I consequently did straight after. So welcome back. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, really good.
Protracted intro there.
Yeah, really good. I'm it's super cool to hear that after our conversation that may have helped a little bit of inspiration to go into your own road trips.
That's massive, cool. Not a little bit. Very sweet. It was, and it wasn't that I didn't want to go and do some road trips. There was a bit of a trepidation around. I haven't got the best track record, and we'll get into that. But it was just having that confidence and even knowing what I should go and do, where I should go, you know, what roads I should chase down. Should it be, because I've been to the Nürburgring before, but should I go and do something like that? Or actually, to your point, when we were talking, actually, there's more to the world than that one place.
Do you know what it is? It's often enough when you say to people, oh, you should do this, we should try that. Or they say, oh, actually, if they're convinced that what you're saying is actually worthwhile, they say, oh, I'd love to. I'll do that one day.
Yeah.
And that's the word.
That's the key.
When someone says one day, that's the problem. Yeah. It's like, no. You have to set a date.
Yeah.
When are you going?
Yeah.
And what are the steps you're going to take to get to that goal, that objective? And it's not just a trip, a car trip. It's like whatever you want to do in life. You have to set. Yeah. It's not a one day. It's a set a date and then figure out the steps you need to get there. Yeah. And don't look at the very top of the mountain. Because if you look at the very top of the mountain, then it's really
terrifying.
Intimidating.
Yeah, it's
terrifying.
Before we get into the road trips and kind of your experiences of that and mine as well, mate, Megaphonics, bravo, sir. I mean, I was lucky enough to be on the Michelin stand with my car, and I got a chance to walk around before everything else opened up, and during and towards the end of the day, and it was bigger and better than it had been before, but it was curated, but it didn't feel pretentious. I mean, everything that you'd hope a Porsche event would be, it had it.
Thanks.
So massive congratulations, but tell me your side of the story, mate.
No, I really appreciate that. Like, since our first interview and the Niners Unplugged episode, like I really bonded with you as an enthusiast. We had the same similar values and so on. So to hear you say that about my event our event more precisely is very kind, and it means a lot. So I appreciate it. Thank you. But
pleasure.
Yeah, no, it was again, it's, you know, this idea for Boxing Gas was just this harebrained idea that came about however many years ago. So to get to a point where we have almost 3,000 people here, and we have people flying in from the US, Dubai, Australia, as mind-boggling that is, you know, for this once little idea that that luckily enough people were kind enough to share with me and want to get involved with, whether it was as a spectator or the brands we work with and the people that are kind enough to, or that I'm lucky enough to have work with me and for me, is super cool. So yeah, when the gates open, you see all these people coming, it's like, okay, they're all here for this.
Yeah.
This little idea that's kind of grown into something substantial, I guess.
What?
Yeah.
Over that period of time, mate, so from early days, Oil Cooled, all the way through to Megaphonics, has your kind of, are you still, your vision that you had, you know, event one to where we are today, is it still the same? Have you kind of, has it changed slightly as you've gone, or is it kind of, you still like, no, I know we're talking about the mountain thing. We're kind of like halfway.
Yeah.
Where is it in that kind of thread?
It's a good point. Good question. I definitely had a clear idea of what I wanted to achieve, what I thought we could do. I had a very clear idea, a clear vision of what I wanted to pull off with the event. Whether we got there or not was going to be a different story.
Yeah.
But the plan was there and the will was certainly there. Has it changed a bit since we set off? I'm not really sure, you know.
Okay.
I think it's pretty much exactly what I had in my head. Mm. You know, I think there are little elements and bits and pieces that change, that have changed, obviously. Yeah. But generally speaking, it's kind of what we set out to achieve. It's kind of what we set out to do.
That's really
cool. So that's really cool. The problem with events is that every time you do one, you got to top it with the next one.
Yeah.
And so the pressure is on. And they only get better with people's, I'm not going to say perseverance, but with people's kind dedication to keep coming year and year.
Yeah.
Because if someone says they come to the first one, they go, oh, that was quite good, but actually I'm going to leave it a couple of years and then I'll come back and see what's happened.
Yeah.
Well, you're not going to, it's only going to, if everybody did that, then you wouldn't be able to get to the third event that person was going to get to, as opposed to skipping the second one or the third one, whatever. I don't quite know what I'm saying. I think what I'm getting at is that they only get better with the people involved. You know, taking part in the events.
I think that's the one thing about this brand and the culture that lives within it is it's so, and it's part of re-engineering and everything goes, all the, I don't like to call them interviews, but let's for argument say interviews. It's always about the person behind it. You know, the cars are obviously the conduit to get the person, you know, and their experiences and their enjoyment and their passion out. But it's always about the people, dude. Yeah. Always.
No, it is. It's 100%. You know, what's it called? I think things don't work without, you know, people rallying together to make something to make something happen. I'm you know, we're very, very lucky. We had over 75 special display cars come in from all over Europe. Three trucks come in with six cars from Europe. Or was it four? I forget. And then a few more trucks over here, and then loads of individual trailers and all the rest of it. And that does not happen without some incredibly generous owners. And you know, this year we had the 917 LH, last year we had one as well. It's a car valued at over 30 million, you know, and the owner.
I just want to pause there. 30 million quid.
Yeah.
You can't gloss over that. And not only that, it'd be on static display within relative terms, arm's reach of people. And the confidence and commitment and the goodwill from the owner to go, actually, I'm okay with that. I'm not going to be eyes on the car the whole time. I'm not going to be deck chair in front of it, fending people away. I'm going to just, it's there for people to enjoy, right?
Yeah, no. I think that the total value of the cars we curated was in the region of 200 million. Once you totted everything up between, like, you know, the 674 RSRs, I think there were, and 9 GT2s and the Zagato Spiders and coupes and all the rest of it. Yeah, it got pretty scary. And it's one of those things where, like, obviously we need to insure these cars and make sure that they get here with security overnight and security during the day, and there's CCTV cameras everywhere, and there's loads of other things I'm probably forgetting in terms of security stuff. But I mean, the guy, to give you just for that one car, the 917 LH, that is, he picked it up in the south of France. He was in Switzerland, but we wanted to use him because we trusted him.
Mm.
And it's just one car with one trailer enclosed that's going from Switzerland all the way to the south of France to pick up this car. And then he's driving it all through south of France, all the way into, I think it was the Netherlands, to get the carnets, because obviously since Brexit, you've got to declare everything you're bringing in, the value and everything else, to get the carnets. And then he's got to go, I think it was into Belgium, and then he's got to go across Calais and you know, it's a long ass journey to do, you know, what's called as to do the way that he did it. And what do you do when you pull into a petrol station? You know, and you pull into a petrol station, you fuel the car, but then you got to go into the petrol station, leave 30 million on the back of the trailer and pray that nothing's going to happen to it. And the pressure of crossing a whole fucking continent, excuse my language.
No, no, help yourself, it's fine.
Crossing the whole continent with this car in your trailer in the slow lane while you've got people overtaking you the whole time. It's frightening.
Dude, it's not even, imagine, so there's been some hellish weather, yeah. You know, at times. And I drove through, this year, I was driving through France, and it was the amount of standing water. Mm-hmm. Now imagine you've got a trailer with 30 million quid. Imagine if you have 30 million actual notes in the boot, and that thing's swaying. In fact, not even that, it's worse, because at least that's, you know, you can replace that. You can't replace the 917LH. So you start getting a bit of a tank slapper on with something like that. It is just, it must be.
No, he's the hero. Yeah, you know, those guys are the heroes. Transporting those cars, because I'd be so anxious. But you know, the owner of that car, he's got a wonderful collection of cars, and he's incredibly generous. You know, so much so that he wasn't even at the event. There are quite a few collectors that had cars on display, and they were just out of their own generosity, were just like, I want people to see, you know, my car. I want people to see these cars. You don't see them every day, and so they, you know, so they lend us the car with no strings attached to go and be enjoyed by the public. And to, you know, to have that, I would be anxious about sending my car 30 million if I had 30 million across the continent, you know. It's just very generous. But you know, it goes back to what you're saying, like the Porsche community is an awesome one. And whether it's the guy in the 924 who came up to me, I think it was last year, and said to me, I've bought my first car, it's a 924, I bought for 1,200 quid or whatever it was. It was 2,500 actually.
If that's you, stick in the comments below and I'll get in touch, because I'll do an episode with you and your 924, mate. Nice one, good work.
And, you know, whether it's him, and he was like, he just passed his license and he'd been coming to the event for the last 5 years, I think it was. Yeah, it was five years. Yeah, yeah. And then he was finally coming in his own Porsche.
So good.
You know, that you know, when he came up to me and said that, that's the reasons why you do those kind of things. Whether it's him or whether it's the guy with the 917LH, you know, getting that kind of wide spectrum of enthusiasm is just, it's awesome. It's awe-inspiring.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm so glad it came off as well as it did. It felt as good as it did. And people clearly had a great time. So I genuinely can't wait to see what happens next.
Yeah, me too. We've got a lot of work to do and a lot of ideas. There's tons of things we want to do and tons of ideas, but it all comes down at the end of the day, it's a budget. You know, what's called it, we've got to make this, it's got to work for us.
Yeah.
And in order for that to happen, it means that every year we've got to put the ticket price up.
Yeah.
And we've got to have the faith that people are going to want to invest in the future of the event and into the next one being bigger and better.
And to that point, actually, the other building you had, the exhibition building that with all the static stands and stuff, that wasn't there last time, was it? That was, was it?
Yeah, it was.
It was.
Yeah, we've had it 2 years on the trot, those two buildings. Yeah.
But the investment in that, right, which is all part of, you know, what makes the event. Because anybody within reason can go, I'm just going to book a field and fill a field full of cars, right? Beautiful as that is, and you can get some great scenery, you start investing in, you know, a place for this stuff to live.
Yeah.
And to kind of grow the brand Boxing Gas and see what happens with that in the future, you've got no choice but to try and recoup some of that investment and then make it grow again, right? Yeah. That's part of business.
That's part of business. It has to work. It has to work. And like, the buildings. I mean, the building with the mezzanine in it, the big one that had that most of the display cars in, that building, the paint was probably still a little bit tacky. The day of Megaphonics, it was that close.
Yeah,
it was really tight getting it done. And I mean, I think over the span of the 7 years we've been building Boxing Gas, we've probably put in about 20 different planning applications.
Wow.
I mean, to give you an idea, that building is effectively a horse managed with a roof on it, with an application for a roof on it, another one to enclose it, another one for the change of use, another one to put glazing into it, actually.
Wow.
And then another one again to change of use. And that's that building alone, you know, and there are four of these.
Yeah.
And you can't do it all in one go because, you know, you've got to prove incrementally that the business is viable to local councils and all the rest of it. And what they call sustainability, which is more about traffic. But it's either that or it's 15 years of planning out of local parishes, traffic analysis and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
If you go in there with one business case. So we went in there and did our built our buildings incrementally, which is why it's taken 7 years. But that's it. We're done now, Paul. So, all the buildings are finished. They're all in the process of being tenanted. And then when we finish with that, then we can finally do more than just Megaphonics.
So let's come to sort of the end of this part of the conversation. But I do want to ask a question outside of Megaphonics, mate. You're talking about, you know, what is your vision for how this place is going to be used as an opportunity for the rest of the culture and all the people to get involved aside from just that one event? What's the future for that? Do you know yet?
Yeah, the future is about inclusivity. The same thing as about Megaphonics, right? It's about a home away from home, a place that feels like your own, a place for one and for all. And I don't want that to be just once a year, or whether you're visiting a business that is renting space here, like Auto Farm or whatever. So ideally, we're going to start doing monthly meets.
Cool.
On a regular basis. It won't be to the same extent as Megaphonics.
Yeah.
It'll be much more of a kind of cars and coffee style of thing, but with our own flavor, our own twist that makes it uniquely, hopefully, our own, or that makes it distinctively our own. So we'll do that once a month. I estimate that the Ace Cafe in central London, inside the ULEZ, on a Monday night, on a monthly basis, they have their Porsche meet. I think they rope in about 400, 500 cars a month at best during the summer months. If you go there, not for the cars, you're left with the food, which isn't great. With all due respect to the Ace Cafe and the institution, that is what that is.
I mean, it's an icon, but it's a
greasy spoon. And there's nothing wrong with greasy spoons. They are what they are.
Yeah. And but in fact, it wouldn't, in my opinion anyway, it would do it a disservice if it came massively gentrified, because it's never intended to be that.
No. And it has its place suddenly in my heart, you know, and as a biker and as a Porsche enthusiast, it's a place that I've been to over the years and I have a lot of respect for and a lot of heritage for.
Yeah.
Has a lot of heritage and therefore respect for. But I think that if we can do a monthly Porsche event outside of the ULEZ, not on a Monday evening, on a Saturday or a Sunday, and we're 90 minutes from over 50% of the entire UK's population, we should be seeing maybe 500 cars being pessimistically a month.
That's
what I'd like.
I think you're going to be a victim of your own success. As with Megaphonics, right, the love for this place and the brand and everything that goes with it is huge. So I think that's a conservative estimate.
Well, fingers crossed, we'll see.
It's going to have to be ticketed, because you're going to end up with like 1,000 people.
Has to be, because again, it's got to be a business. It's got to run.
Of course.
You know, what's it called? So we'll do that. And then the other side of it is that Porsche as a brand has always been very astute in bringing in new clients or new marketplaces, approaching new marketplaces, capturing new marketplaces. And you see that through the activations they do. One of them, for example, being Type 7. So Type 7 is an Instagram channel for those Type 7.
If you haven't seen it, check it out.
It's an Instagram channel. But like, what is on there is probably what? Majority of it is art, architecture, music, design, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's a percentile, a smallish one, about Porsches. But the principal idea behind that is grabbing a new marketplace that would potentially have an interest in Porsche that don't have any interest in it, and bringing them into the fold.
Wow.
And they do that constantly with their marketing, you know, in their collaborations with different brands, whether it's Emma Raducanu, the tennis player, or whatever it may well be, Daniel Arsham, so on and so forth. It goes on and on and on. And I think it would be short-sighted of us to let Porsche restrict us. I think it needs to empower us. So while Porsche is definitely in our DNA, I don't want it to be the only thing that we're about.
Interesting.
So when you look at but with the Porsche twist to it.
Yep.
So when you look at Megaphonics as a brand, you know, it taps into the different interests our demographic are into. It's not just Porsche.
Yeah.
There's food there. That's a big part of it. All sold from vintage vehicles, all artisanal. There's music. It's highly curated. You're talking experimental beach club, kind of Ibiza vibes, to use a very millennial word. And then you've got 90s, you know, Mos Def, Lordy by Nature kind of raps, are very slow. So we're playing into like food and music. And then you've got fashion brands and clothing brands and what, sunglass brands and jewelry brands. So we're tapping into the things that our demographic are into, which is watches, what Porsches are about. Watches as well.
Porsche designed the little stand that they had up in the mezzanine area. I was like, wow, that's so cool.
No, it was great to have them come on board as a sponsor this year, to have a timing partner like that. It was awesome.
Yeah.
But suffice to say, as you know, like what's called, we're all cut from the same cloth. What we appreciate in Porsche is reliability, design, you know, craftsmanship, and those three elements can be found in so much more than just cars. So I think Box and Gas, as a representation of Porsche, and to align ourselves with Porsche, who sponsor Megaphonics and who are involved with us as a brand, I think that we need to tap into the things that our demographic are into also. So we will probably do a non-Porsche event on a monthly basis as well.
Interesting.
Which will have obviously a strong Porsche contingent.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know about you, I love Porsches, there's no doubt about it, but I have interest in other cars too. And what really gets me going isn't necessarily what you drive, it's the person behind it.
Yeah.
The guy who's got a Citroen Saxo, who's put all his love and TLC into it and has built like a track monster or something, I don't know, and has got some incredible memories, that's the guy I want to talk to.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in the individual with the passion, with common interests, than I am necessarily into an object or a thing. So Porsche will always be in our DNA. Box and Gas is about Porsche, there's no doubt about it. But we are going to let the brand empower us in the same way the Porsche itself does in terms of the things that we do.
On that, if you're watching this and you're watching it on YouTube, stick in the comments below and let Frank and I know what you would like to see from Box and Gas in the future. Who knows? But yeah, stick in the comments below and let us know. Road trips. You've just got back. This car has clearly not been touched since we'll put our six and B-roll in. But firstly, thank you for putting it on Instagram. Stories constantly coming out. And I got, I think a few people messaged me and had said, have you seen what they're up to today? And I was like, of course I have. I've looked at the stories the same as you, mate. Talk me through, before we get into like the first ever, you know, road trip and all that stuff, how did this go? What
the car itself?
Yeah, well, the trip and the car.
Okay, the trip and the car. I mean, yeah, it went very well. It's not without its battle scars now. There's some work to do now in the winter on the car. You know, what's called, we had to replace the tires halfway through on the rear because we were on the canvas.
Wow. Is that through an aggressive GO? That's
Part of it is to do with aggressive GO, and also part of it is to do with the fact that, you know, the cars have been on the car, the wheels have been on the car, the tires have been on the car for a while.
Okay.
And it's been 6,000 miles now, over a month. So what's called, the car got hammered up and down Alpine passes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, as you say, if we have a walk around it later, you'll see there's loads of stickers for every mountain pass I did. And having said that, there are a few stickers I couldn't find because the shop wasn't open that I could buy the sticker from. But yeah, it's been pretty awesome.
And do me a favor, and for those of you that didn't see, what summarize this trip? What sort of, where did you go? What sort of places did you hit?
So basically, there's Porsche as a brand have their independent communities. We are lucky enough to be one of them, Box and Gas. Amongst that, you've got all the other usual players like Anasis in Germany, Lufkakul, Das Treffen in Thailand. What else? There's another one. There's some from all over the place.
Yeah.
And so the idea was they wanted to bring all of these independent communities together to do a big road trip. And at the same time, use it as a marketing exercise for what these cars are built to do in some ways. So you had all these different individuals who represented these different brands coming together for this road trip. So it was organized by Porsche and attended to by these people. And so it was a seven-day tour, starting in Stuttgart and finishing in Nice in the south of France. And every day was a different hotel. And every day was several mountain passes. And I think in total, we were probably around 40, 50 people. Luckily, the groups split up into smaller groups because you can't do 50 cars on a mountain pass.
Yeah, of course.
But it was an awesome exercise. It was an awesome trip in the sense that it was an opportunity to catch up with people in a casual setting, build relationships, build friendships.
Did you know most of the people?
Quite a few.
Yeah, cool.
Quite a few, yeah. Because, I don't know, you know, the nature of the Porsche communities is very open and very friendly, and we will talk and we will help each other out. So Just here in the UK, for example, you've got Classics of the Clubhouse,
yeah,
run by PJ,
yeah,
who is a wonderful guy, mutual friend of ours, and has a grand fantastic 306. He's helped me out on a few things with Megaphonics, and vice versa. If you ever wanted my help, then he's very welcome to call me. There's also Jay from Players Show.
Yeah.
What's it called? He helped us out of a sticky situation with Megaphonics this year, and we got through it. And that's a whole different story. But the point is that what's called the community is very open, and we all understand that if we work together, we strive together. Mm-hmm. We strive together, we succeed together. And there's no reason why we can't all help each other out. There's enough differentiation between what we do for us all to grow together. So it was just that road trip was a great opportunity to catch up with people and get going. And the wonderful thing about it actually is it was spearheaded by the head of marketing at Porsche AG. So he came up with the concept of this road trip, and he's got access to any Porsche he wanted for that trip.
Right.
And even to us, they said to us, would you like us to supply you with a loaner car for the trip?
Huh.
You know, so he could definitely go with whatever he wanted. Yeah. But he went with a really gnarly, hot-rodded, air-cooled Porsche. And it was just awesome to see his appreciation, not only for the awesome new products that Porsche create, but also, you know, for the older stuff too.
Yeah.
So there's a really good mixture of like the brand new Taycan GT, I can't remember what it's called, the one that did the lap record around the Nürburgring that's completely stripped out.
I'm not very good with the Taycans, I've got to be honest, but I know which one you mean. Yeah.
There was that all the way down to a 356 that did the whole trip as well. So it was awesome seeing the whole plethora of Porsche material on that trip.
But now you've got to ring Michelin up and get some spare tires.
It's too late. I had to change them on the trip.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I had to change them on the trip. And then the other thing is because for my sins, the car is too low because it was originally built as a track car.
Yeah.
So I pulled into a car park and I ripped the one of the side pipes on the exhaust straight off the car. And then it did damage and bent things out of place. So I was all anxious about that. So then I called up one of my friends from Heiser Club, who were a sponsor of Megaphonics, who were a sponsor of their events.
Yeah.
This is another Global Communities guy. And I said to him, listen, do you know of a Porsche garage around Stuttgart? He was like, yeah, no problem. What's the problem with the car, blah, blah. He said, I'll call you back. He calls me back 30 minutes later. He said, I booked you in with this guy. Niklas is the person to talk to at Boxer Motor. Go there. They'll sort you all out, blah, blah. And it was, again, just an awesome example of how, you know, when you've got a problem, this global community, you can ring up anyone and, you know, what's it called, and get help.
Do you know what? I think it's beyond the community because where was I? I was at the Col de la Bonnette. On the axis, sort of the start as you go up the hill, or the mountain, should I say, pulled over. And I pulled over not for any negative reason. I just pulled over and I was going to take a minute because it was a beautiful shot. Some guy, I don't know what it was, like a people carrier, pulls over and says, can I help you? Is there anything I can do for you? You look like you're stuck. And I was like, well, firstly, thank you so much because you could have just bombed straight past, right, and ignored this guy in a white Porsche. But I think there's something, again, something about the brand. Maybe it's the smile on my face, I don't know what it was. But the guy was just really decent, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think it's one of those brands that attracts that, especially if you've got something that's a bit gnarly.
Yeah.
PJ gets it all the time, right? His car looks scruffy and it wouldn't look good any other way than looking like a survivor.
Yeah.
But people are always so cool about it.
Yeah. No, it's a really cool brand to be involved with for sure. But yeah, road tripping is, it's something else. I mean, like what's called, you've done an Alpine tour now. What do you think of it?
I immediately wanted to plan another one as soon as I got back.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why I'm stumbling around is because it was so impactful for me. I really, at that particular time, and I find it funny enough, I came up with Richard Tuthill this morning. It was Col de la Bonnette. I pulled up at the peak. And if you don't know about this, Col de la Bonnette is the highest looped road in Europe. And it was something about that as a, like, if you're going to do a road trip and you're going to do your first set of passes, go to the highest place you can find. And I just sat back and I just couldn't believe that I'd spent so long thinking about doing something like this. And then actually, it wasn't that complicated to get there. I made more of a meal out of it planning than actually getting in the car and going. But what it gave me back, especially doing it solo, and I think I'll always now do a blend of trips with other people and solo stuff. I was the cost was minimal because I wanted to stay in quite relatively low budget places. And I found this off peak ski chalet. It's like 45 euros for a night. And I parked up there. The car was in front of the chalet. And I sort of sat out. The sun was starting to set because I got there at a sensible time. And I just was like, what is life, you know? And for the same price of that entire trip, it would have been a trip to, you know, an all-inclusive somewhere. And yeah, there is no comparison in terms of what you get back from a trip like that versus a trip to somewhere that's kind of an all-inclusive.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's what I find from road trips is they can do two things. Like one, there's a lot of mileage on motorways to get to where you need to get to.
That's true.
And there's that time where you can't do anything else because you're driving. So sometimes you're lost with your thought, and there's a lot of self-reflection that can happen in that kind of empty space.
Yeah.
And then there's the other side of it, which is when you're up the mountains and all the rest of it, then you really don't have time to think about anything else.
Yeah.
So you become incredibly present.
And it's a Japanese thing called Zanshin and Mushin.
Okay.
And Mushin is the awareness of everything.
Right, right.
And Zanshin is the pinpoint focus.
Right, interesting.
And it's, and I find it, you're absolutely right, that kind of opportunity where you're killing motorway miles or kilometers on an auto route and you can't speed, so there's nothing fun you can do. And actually it's all Mushin. It's all kind of everything going on, and actually it's like an open space for you to kind of walk around in. Sure. And then you get to something like, for me, Col de Torino, and you can't about with that, right? No. You're on it. No. So yeah.
So Col de Torino is an interesting one, actually, because one side of it I find impossible. I don't know if you found that. And the other side of it's perfect. There's one side of it that is incredibly tight.
It's just like this.
Yeah, and it's not a pleasurable experience. Yeah. You're like first, second gear, and it's just a nightmare. And the other side of it's really, really good.
Yeah.
But Col de Torino, I remember it came up in Top Gear many years ago and they called it the best driving road in the world. And I was
it's
like,
not.
Absolutely not. It really isn't.
It's not.
Especially
I'm glad I did
side.
It.
Yeah. Bucket list, ticked, job done.
Yeah.
But honestly, the one for me is probably the Sistan Pass.
Okay.
And the Nufnen. But the Sistan is like, the truth is when you're driving a pace, you want to have as much visibility as possible, right? Because there's nothing's going to slow you down more than the fear of, God forbid, something happening around the next corner.
Yeah.
You know, you go into something. Yeah. So if you've got good visibility, then you're winning, you know, then you know what's coming up and the road feels safe, and then you can add on speed safely and you're confident. So I prefer passes which are wider, more open, freer flowing. You can see what's coming up, and you can really get into a really nice rhythm, because that's what it is. It's that rhythm, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rowing up and down the gears and all the rest of it, breaking points and so on. Whereas like if you can't see around the next corners, there's that hesitation.
Totally.
And suddenly that rhythm breaks apart.
Yeah.
So things like the Sistan for me is just way up there. It's gorgeous. Starts off in the woods. And it's beautiful that way. And you've got to be a little bit careful because it's wooded, it's overcast. So the road isn't always really, really dry.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it opens up and the mountain just expands, just explodes in front of you. And it's just these huge open vistas, which are just absolutely gorgeous. And then you go through these tiny little rock tunnels, you know? So you have that.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But you just go, it's not even like, maybe three cars wide, but when you're blading through it, it just goes in and out. You're coming in and out of these tunnels.
Yeah. It's the sonic changes.
Yeah, that too.
It's because you get this kind of, obviously the exhaust, the noise is reverberating off the side of the rock. But then it kind of, as you pull, come straight out again, it stops and your ears take a second to catch up. And then you're into another one again. Mm. And that, it's like a pulsing almost if you're going through a load of it. It's fucking amazing.
Oh, it is absolutely amazing. And they actually capture that quite well in Casino Royale, the Daniel Craig film, in a weird way. It's a completely different thing. But you know what's cool? There's that bit where at the beginning of the film, there's that car chase in the DBS, the 2010 DBS manual. And the light is coming through the tunnel.
Yeah.
And it's that really captured it quite well. But no, I think... You know, I'm lucky enough to have done a lot of things with cars, you know, whether it's track days, just general Euro trips, weekend stuff, car shows, and Alpine tours. And where I feel most at home and where I feel, where I love to be with a car more than anything is in an Alpine pass.
Mm.
You bring the quality of the roads, the views, great bunch of people, culture, interesting food, wherever you go. And just that blend is just an intoxicating blend of just awesome.
With you knowing so much about some of these, you obviously, you know, your knowledge base is huge now in terms of a lot of this stuff. Because one of the things I found is that I was staying in Grasse So I had Route Napoleon right next to me, basically. And a friend of mine, he jumped on his supermoto and said, look, follow me, I'll take you some roads that, that aren't the roads that people typically go on, but they're much better. And suddenly there was traffic until he turned right and everyone went left. And I was like, fine, I'll follow that guy. And then suddenly it did, it opened up and it was just this kind of like sweeping roads. That, and because he knew them all, he was staying far enough in front and he'd flash me if I needed to slow down or whatever, like, you know, but just that. So I can imagine once you've got that kind of local knowledge for some of these passes and or kind of some of the connecting bits, right? Not even the ones that people go to, but the joining bits, that then opens up another experience.
Right? Yeah, definitely, definitely. And to give you my top tips, if I can. I would say stay in one hotel. Stay in a few if you need to, but the majority of your time should be in one hotel. And then from there, you can spear off into different areas. Because what that means is you can get the luggage out of the car. You're not repacking your bag every night, which is a bit of a mare, to be honest. Your car's a little bit lighter because it hasn't got all the luggage. And some of these older cars, that's critical. That can make a big difference. And also it means that if some people inside your group want to go back early or they don't want to go out that day, you're all going back to the same place, so there's no pressure.
Yeah.
What I've learned over the years is that whenever there's pressure, that's when you've got likelihood of accidents.
Yeah.
And I think over the years I've been witness to about 3 or 4
big ones,
crashes on airplanes. Some bad
big
ones, yeah.
Yikes.
So suffice to say that if you can take off that pressure, then that makes a big difference. Other ways of taking off that pressure, radios. You have to have radios.
Oh, God, yeah.
Absolutely have to have radios. And it's got to be the proper good stuff that works over like 6 mile different ranges.
Yeah.
And then the way I do it is I now create everything on a website called My Route Planner.
Okay.
And then you can download GPX files or Google files, whatever. And then that does all your waypoints from the different areas.
I didn't know this, by the way. I'm learning stuff today. Yeah. So,
my route then planner. Afterwards, everybody in the WhatsApp group has got like all the routes there. They all know where they're going.
Right.
Because the problem is if you're going, if you and me are going, and I know where we're going, but you don't know where you were going, you're going to feel pressure to keep up with me.
Totally.
Because what's called, you don't want to get lost. Whereas if you've got it on your phone, on your Google Maps in your car, then effectively, you know, you'll never get lost. We're going to get in the same direction. So you don't feel that pressure and you don't feel that. And that can cause people to take liberties they're not supposed to take. And then you end up with accidents. So having everybody having their own maps on their phone, you know, what's called when everybody knows where they're going, that also helps relieve the pressure for sure. And a lot of prep work as well, making sure the car's in absolutely rude health before you
so
go.
I'm kind of lucky in this respect, right? Because I drop my car into Barnsville. I spanner on it myself, so I kind of know what's good and what's not.
Yeah.
And I get it second checked by Scotty at Barnsville, who's a fucking rock star. And then I'm good to go. Not necessarily the case with an air-cooled car, right? Or something, and not even an air-cooled car, just something that's a bit older.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually it's lived a life and it's less predictable. So you're getting it to rude health. What does that entail for you? Do you spend a bit of time in the lead up going through the whole thing?
Me personally, no, because I've got keyboard fingers and I've got to be precious with those. No, in real terms, if I have some credit, I used to do some spannering. So basic servicing, I've done big red upgrades and anti-roll bars and stuff like that. But I am by no stretch of the imagination a mechanic. And the problem also is I don't have the time and the valuable time that I have left, I need to spend it with family. Really.
Of course you do,
Yeah. And
you've got a guy that comes here, right?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky to have a freelance mechanic who wants a bit of an easier life. And his name's John, and he's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and he comes in and he does my work whenever I need something. So he's really good at fixing things. I'm really good at breaking things. So we have a great relationship. But yeah, basically, in terms of prep, to answer your question, we'll do like a full service on the car.
Yeah.
A full major. Take a view on the brake pads because it's going to be a lot of mileage.
Yeah.
So like what's called fresh pads, fresh discs if necessary.
Yeah.
Fresh, fresh tires are absolutely critical. I take a... like I'm sure you did as well, like, you know, what's called a bag full of obvious tools that you might need.
Get you out of jail free.
Your DME relays for 964s and 993s are essential because if they fail, then the whole car doesn't start. So you buy a new one, you put that one straight in so that you know it works and you put the old one in the glove box.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are little bits and pieces you do. Maps, you know, what's called, in terms of prepping the journey, prepping the roads, like it's just, you know, everything's out there on the internet. We're very lucky.
Yeah.
So there's Stefan, who writes all the Curves magazines, Curves books. He was actually on this trip recently with Porsche, really cool. Nice guy. And he's got some awesome guides to all the best roads around the whole world now. He's going off to Japan soon to do a book out there as well.
Wow.
He was telling me that the first book he did, I don't think I mind me saying this, but it was all self-funded and self-photographed, even though he wasn't a photographer.
Yeah.
And he thought he was doing it mainly because, I don't know, he wanted to do it more than anything. Yeah. And then it's become a huge commercial success now. So all credit to him. He's opened a store in Thailand. It's a different story. But yeah, spending some time going through those books about the roads you want to do and on Google, and then just chucking them all into Google Maps and into a blender and seeing what comes out. But I think the advice I would give is that there's so much to do around the Alps alone.
Yeah,
you start totally. Going, you know, further afield, Pyrenees, whatever. But my advice would be to stick to one area.
Yeah.
You know, like what's called, we spent a few nights in Saint Maurice this year, and there's a lot to do in that area. And that's where I'd recommend spending a lot of good time. The French side of the Alps, I think the roads are a little bit busier and not as smooth. The German Italian side is brilliant.
Yeah.
So that's a place to go. And then the other side is, you know, what's called, don't go in the summer, because obviously there's all the tourists and caravans and you don't want to be caught in that.
Cyclists. You know, it's their roads too, but exactly. In fact, that's a really good point. You don't own those roads.
No.
Don't turn up and be an asshole and kind of just hog everything, you know, terrible blind overtaking. I mean, that is just... Yeah. It gives everybody in the scene, you know, a bad rep.
It does. Yeah, we have a responsibility, right? To all, like, not make a scene. And we're guests in other people's countries.
100%.
I mean, when you're up in the mountain and landing on a mountain pass in the middle of nowhere, go for it.
Oh, fine. Yeah.
But, like, absolutely. It's still things like going through little villages and stuff like that, where you just got to be a bit just more conscientious.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally.
And I would always recommend going, like, end of August, very early September, because everyone's going back to school and it's just before the snow comes in. But it can be from 1 week to the next, you can have snow.
Yeah, we saw that 2 weeks ago, right?
There was,
crazy.
So I did 10 days with a group of friends from the UK around the Alps. Then I came back here briefly, and then headed off on this trip with Porsche, and that was another 7 days. It was a lot of time on the road.
Mm.
Yeah, we did. Holland, Belgium, France, Switzerland, Italy, Germany, Austria, and probably in the region of 6,000 miles.
That is intense.
Yeah. I'm glad to be home.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
3 weeks worth of luggage, 4 weeks worth of luggage in there. Yeah. No washing machine necessarily in certain places. So, you know, luckily these cars are incredibly practical. By the time you get squishy bags in the back and then the boot, actually there's, you can squish a lot of
it. Get all of it in, yeah.
But I'm very happy to be back and... to do some laundry and to
do some admin.
Yeah, and get back to work now as well.
It's fascinating when you're talking about, I was, you know, intently listening about the do's and don'ts and some of those kind of best tips, and then at the same time reflecting on the fact that I basically didn't do any of them. So my trips, the first one, so a couple of years back when I came on Niners Unplugged, there was a big schlep across France, the difficult bit you've got to do to get down to the south of France. Broke it in half, stayed in Charmes, lovely little town, but I was literally there within 9 hours, I think, because I made some mistakes. Went to bed, got up in the morning and did the next kind of 8 or 9 hours to Monaco. And then I did the bit that I made a mistake of, because that's, you've got to do that journey, right? If you're going to get down there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd booked a new place to stay every day.
Yeah.
And it was brutal.
Yeah.
It was absolutely, don't get me wrong, I love that trip. I will always, that's the first big one I ever did. I did it solo, so it's always going to be meaningful. But there was, when you're tired from just doing a commute from one place to the next, the will to then spend the last few hours and, you know, golden hour chasing around the, you know, mountains, it just gone because I was tired, right? I'd done 3 days on the banks trying to get to it. So, the big bit you've got to go, you know, do to get to where you want to be, fine, get out of the way, and then just find places, even if it's two or three different places, but stay in an area rather than trying crushing things by ticking boxes the whole time.
It's also quality, not quantity.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to pick your moments as well. You can't, you know, there are some mountain passes that, you know, where I felt really on it. You know, everything felt right and the conditions were good and the car felt right and everything else. And then the next day, or the next mountain pass, I'm like, actually, I don't feel it this time. I'm going to take a step back. And the other thing is also, like, everybody's cars are different and everybody's inverted commas abilities are different too.
100%.
So like, for example, while this is really good at something like the Cistern or the Gotthard, whatever, something like the Stelvio or actually the old Gotthard, which is all cobblestones all the way up.
Right.
This is such a stiff car because it was built for track car. Yeah. You shouldn't really, I don't know, it's road legal, but like what's it called? It's very tough on the road.
Yeah.
Something like the old Gotthard, which is all cobblestones way up, that was like 5 miles an hour the whole way. Because like what's called the car so stiff, I was rattling fillings. The guys were taking the piss out of me by the time we got up to the top.
So they'd all
they
shot.
Roaring with laughter. And I was like, I'll meet you guys at the top.
They're smoking the cigars.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. They were like, we'll meet you at the top. Because I was like, I'll meet you at the top. I'll do the new Gotthard, which is all nice and smooth. You guys do the cobblestones.
Yeah.
Like, oh, come on, Frank, we're part of the team. We've got to do this together.
Yeah,
where's your, you know, camaraderie, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, fine. Anyway, they were pissing themselves by the time they got to the top. The point is I'm making is that that's something you need to take into consideration. Also, when you're doing these kind of tours with other cars, is to understand, actually, my car's good at this. Your car's good at that.
Yeah.
Let me let you through. You do your thing because you're feeling it right now. I'm not.
Yeah.
And recognizing that actually, right now, I'm a little bit tired. You know, what's it called? The car doesn't feel 100%. This road isn't 100% right for me at this moment in time, let alone my car.
Yeah.
I think it's important as well. Because again, otherwise you end up with just bad quality driving and potentially issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one wants that, right? It's because that is, I mean, I've luckily not seen it, but you know, this, the idea of a friend or someone you're with having a bad time, that's going to be, you know, I'm an empathetic person. So I'd be like, that's your fucking holiday, dude. That's completely trash now. Even if you come out of it perfectly okay. And actually, let's face it, some of those passes, it is like,
yeah, totally. So I'm one of those people. So on one of these Alpine tours, I think it was about 10, 12 years ago, I had a crash.
Did you?
Yeah, it was really stupid and really simple, but the throttle body just stuck open.
Wow.
And I had the choice in between a rock face or the cliff edge. So I chose the rock face and I went in there probably around 60 miles an hour.
Wow.
But it suddenly felt like that at the time. And I had to pull myself out the driver's window. Had a slip disc in my neck. You know, the car was just, you know, what's called, I pulled myself out of the car and the car was just bouncing off the rev limiter because the throttle had stuck open. And that was pretty rough. It was pretty rough. And at that time I was working very hard on building this business. And that was my biggest priority. And I wasn't paying enough attention to friends and family at that time. And it was one of those moments where I was just like, I could have died that day. If I'd known I was going to die that day, I would have lived my life very differently and I would have probably spend a bit more time with my friends and my family. So that was
perspective, right?
That yeah, that the was weirdest a lot of moments. Perspective. Yeah. That was a lot of perspective. And it was physically, it was painful. Fine. Can deal with that. Emotionally, it was very difficult. And it took a lot of time for me to get over that. But suffice to say that these are mechanical devices and mechanical devices can go wrong. And when they go wrong on a track, you go into the kitty litter and eventually into the tires and you're okay with your roll cage and your helmet and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
You do that on a mountain pass, it is a cliff edge or a rock face. So, you know, preparing and having the right outlook on how to attack or how to drive a big tour, I think is really important. And certainly I learned my lesson, you know, I learned my lesson the hard way in some ways. But I think in those days also, like I drove, now it wasn't my fault because the throttle body stuck open, but fundamentally, I think you need to drive with mechanical sympathy, knowing that there's a possibility that something could go wrong.
Yeah.
So you give yourself a margin of error.
100, you should be on a road anyway, right?
And at that time, I've got to be honest, like I was younger, stupider, marginally more. And as a result, you know, what's it called? I think I didn't give myself enough margin for mechanical failure. And so I've got to say that nowadays I pick my moments a lot more and I have a lot more mechanical sympathy. And I think of it much more as a marathon than as a sprint.
Totally.
Yeah. And I'm very thankful for having made it out of that, you know, and that my friends were great with me after that, what's called dealing with the repercussions of it. Because the car was essentially a complete write-off.
What car was it?
It was a 964.
Right.
Yeah, it was a 964. Yeah. Quite a nice one as well.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Well, so there's difficult and sad times in that circumstance. I'm not immune to that. I think I was lucky enough that my experience didn't mean that there was any injury or kind of, it was pride more than anything else. But so I had a Lotus Elise that I'd rebuilt. In fact, no, it's pre-rebuilt. I had it for about 5 years by that point. Now, for those of you that don't know, No ABS, no traction control, no power steering, nothing.
Just balls of steel.
It's light car, heavy balls. those things are amazing, right? They are. I will die on a hill for Lotus. They're not the most reliable cars in the world.
Sure.
That car had been reliable for 4 straight years.
Yeah.
And on the day of a trip to the Nürburgring, I made it 20 minutes out of my hometown. And the throttle linkage at the pedal end snapped. Like, you can't make that stuff up. So we had, again, you know, youth on your side, Top Gear rules. So fuck you. You got 15 minutes. Otherwise, we're off. 15 minutes went past, and I was, you know, again, I had a rescue bag in the back, but I had some climbing rope and some sticky tape and a couple of zip ties. That was it. So throttle pedal was completely just flapping around, was just disconnected. The cable was okay. So I rigged up the climbing rope to the cable and the tiny little bit of modulation was left, and had a hand throttle. So to drive, I had hand throttle, brake, clutch. So, but it's binary on and off. I drove from Cirencester, just down the road, I'd get to Eurotunnel and we'd fix in the car park properly, find some way, everyone would dive on it and try and fix it. Yeah. That didn't happen because we ended up being slightly late. So we got there and got shoehorned straight onto the tunnel. I was still driving with the fucking car, the hand throttle. Got onto the train, got to the other side, and we're like, cool, right, let's try and fix this. No one can fix it. I drove from Cirencester to the ring with a hand throttle. Got there. Luckily, where we were staying, there was a guy next door with a welder, managed to weld it back together, so it was okay. Cool, I've had my luck. That's my bad luck for the trip. We had a TBR with us, and that radiator let go as well, but that's TBR. One lap of the ring, and on the final straights before you coming back into the car park, coil pack let go. Try and get a K-Series coil pack.
Sorry, did I understand correctly? You did the Nürburgring with a hand throttle.
No. We'd fixed it by then.
Okay, sorry.
We'd got to the ring. We'd got to our chalet, wherever we were staying, his house. And the guy next door had a welder in his garage. Yeah. So I got under there and we took the linkage off, welded it all back up, put it back on, and we were good to go, right?
Yeah.
Pedal back. And it was kind of that first lap ever of the ring. I'd never, ever driven the ring before. And it was a gentle trip round. I wasn't trying to set records. And then, and I was so excited. I had a full lap ticket. All I wanted to do was just do some gentle laps. And it was that last straight 120-ish mile an hour. Gone. And I literally coasted into the car park. And that was my ring trip over. So doesn't always work out, right? You know, and I think the thing that I learned from that trip, and if anybody that was with me on that trip is watching or listening to this, I apologize. I was the most bad-tempered asshole for the next 4 or 5 days. So I think that's part of it, right? Is that quite often with these trips, something will go wrong for somebody, not necessarily with you,
true,
but with somebody on that trip. If you can have a sense of humor about it or help somebody find their sense of humor about it, everyone benefits.
Yeah.
If you find that thing that's gone wrong and let that dictate what the trip's like for you or your mood for the trip, you're letting that situation take control of the entire trip, not for you, but for everybody. So that's my hot tip, is whatever happens, try and, you know, maintain a sense of humor about these things. You can hop in someone else's car and go for some laps. You can, if you can't fix a car, and I couldn't, my car got recovered back to the UK. Let it happen, you know.
Oh, it happens. Like, I've had a car recovered back to the UK. I mean, like I said, it's been, you know, a little while that I've been doing these trips, and it's happened to me before a couple of times, I think. Maybe just once, but I've broken down and we couldn't fix it and had to get recovered back to the UK. I think it's just part and parcel of it, really.
It is,
unfortunately. And the thing is, like, at the end of the day, like, it's a punishing enough trip, you know, for like a modern car.
Yeah.
But it's a very punishing trip for an old car. And there's often something that's going to go wrong. And if you think about it, you do a track day, you're doing 50 minutes out on track. Now, albeit at very, very high intensity and probably the highest intensity the car will go through. But on these Alpine tours, you're doing, like, sometimes you can be doing 8-hour days or 6-hour days, you know. It's a lot of driving for 6 hours straight when you're concentrating really hard and really in the moment and really, you know, doing your thing. And that's a lot of stress to put
and
these cars through.
And brakes as well, dude.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've got big brakes on this thing, but, like, there was one pass we came down on, and they got a little bit uncomfortably hot, you know, and I had high boiling point brake fluid and everything was good about it. But when I got out of the car, all of us felt actually that was a little bit too quick going down that pass. It was one of the first downhill passes we'd done on that trip this year. And we were just like, actually, we need to rein it back in. I think that's the hardest part actually, is on the cars, is the downhill stuff, the brakes.
Totally.
It really, really is. The uphill stuff, you know, it's much more comfortable. And I find I'm at a faster pace like going uphill.
Really?
Downhill, even though, like, what's it called? Obviously, you've got all that momentum, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
It's just that bit much more.
It's almost like you're having to stop yourself running away, whereas going uphill, you're much more in control of the pace.
I mean, what's called the gravity gives you however much horsepower, you know?
Yeah.
Like coming out of turns or coming out of going down the hill or whatever it is. Whereas you're fighting gravity every time you're going up these mountain passes when they go up to something like 2,600 meters or whatever. Mm. So suffice to say that, I think going uphill, usually, what's it called, you're good. It's going downhill where it can, I find it can get very taxing. The pace can be a little bit too quick. It's when I get a little bit anxious, is when I'm going a little bit too quickly, going downhill, and the brakes are getting a real beating, and actually I'm much more comfortable going up.
And I think there's probably something to be said for being, and maybe this is a maturity thing, maybe you're just getting older, just saying to your mates, dude, that was probably a bit quick for me, or I'm probably going to hang back for this one, and just being okay with saying that rather than just being like,
oh, totally,
all full of balls and matching.
No, if you're going on a trip where you don't feel comfortable enough to say to someone, actually, this one, I'm going to let you through, I'm feeling a little bit tired, then you're in there with the wrong people.
Yeah.
You need to be in there with people that you feel very comfortable with. You know, like what's called, you're driving together in tandem, something might go wrong to your car. Mm. You're spending, the other thing is also like generally, you know, when you go away on holiday with someone, it's a lot of time to spend with an individual.
Oh, for sure.
So you really want to be out there with people you know. There's nothing worse than being stuck on a holiday or living with someone that you don't want to live with.
For sure.
Your housemate when you're a student or whatever. So like what's called, I think it's, if you need to be able to be in a zone where you say to someone, actually, I can hear something's not quite right with my car. I'm really sorry. Yeah. You guys go ahead, but I'm going to stop. If they want to stop, great.
And actually the reciprocation of that is when someone says that to you, you're like, no, of course. No worries. We'll see you later. Have a nice trip. We'll grab some food later.
Yeah, done. Exactly. But I think there's also got to be the state of mind. You need to understand that some people are going to drive faster than you, and you've got to be okay with them heading off.
You don't
want to slow them down.
No.
And they've got to be okay with the fact that what's called that you drive slower also. You know, there's got to be the mutual respect that actually people and cars do it at their own pace. You're going into the same place anyway.
Mm.
You're going to go to the same restaurant place, the same dinner place. So there is no point in, you know, having stress or egos or none of that.
No.
Egos when you're driving is not a good thing to have. Egos are the best of times are not a good thing to have.
And Honda makes it, can call that shit out. You know, I can confidently say that, you know, whilst I don't want to admit it, there's been I've had an ego before, and I've needed someone, and I've got a great wife, and she pulls me down straight away. So, but your mate should be able to do that as well, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Even if you can't see it, and you think, oh no, I'm well within my comfort zone, I'm 6 tenths, and they're looking at you going, no, mate.
Hmm.
You know,
yeah.
If you weren't taking this next time, what out of this lot, mate, what would you grab?
Good question. So, Olive, I've done the tour a couple of years on the trot with. And that's been a brilliant car, good amount of horsepower, very light, so fantastic. So I'd be tempted to do that again. But actually what I'm really tempted to do is underneath this cover that you can't see off camera is Black Betty. It's the car that I've owned the longest and that I've created the most memories with. So it's the car that I'm most attached to.
Mm. And actually that came up on the end of our first
time. It did,
time.
And nothing's changed since the car is still, the car is here now. And it's a shell ready to be built up. The dry build's been done now. But that car, because my favorite thing to do with a car is alpine passes, I've built that car to do alpine passes. So everything, you know, is designed to do that. So the what's called the powertrain, the way the power is delivered, the gearbox, the running gear, like suspension, all of the rest of it, the interior, the sound system, you know, the lightweightness of it in certain areas and not in others, and the whole thing's made of carbon fiber. The point is that what's called, it's designed to do one job absolutely. So theoretically, if I could take any of these cars on an Alpine tour, that would be the one, once it's got four wheels and a steering wheel and I can actually drive it and not just sit in the shell and make broom broom noises. So yeah, that would be way up there. Realistically, it's going to be a while since I finished that car, but I think my 3.8 RSR in the back there would be pretty pretty awesome
pretty
to do the trip.
I don't remember seeing that before.
Yeah, well, it's been on axle stands underneath the mezzanine for the last however many editions of Megaphonics. Yeah. And John said to me, Frank, it's getting a little bit embarrassing. We need to get this car on its wheels now. So the engine's just come back from, a little while ago now, actually, from Nick Full James, mm-hmm. who's the head engine builder at Tuttle. He used to have his own shop where he used to push out like 45, 50 engines, air-cooled engines out a year. Madness. That's all he ever did. Wow. And anyway, now he works at Tuttle. And he built the engine in that. So, it's amazing because it's a 3.8 RSR engine. And it's from a race car. When you buy an old race car, you don't know what you're going to find.
No,
you know,
it's not like
bang it together and get it to win the race, right?
Yeah,
So I was a bit worried about what we'd find inside, but actually we found there was a 934 oil pump with two scavengers and all the rest of it, which was an incredibly rare part, but it was a common upgrade in period. So that was really cool. And we also found that all the heads were appropriate because normally on a 964, the exhaust valves are coated, and I think it's ceramic. I forget. Anyway, it's coated, and effectively you can't make those bigger. You can't port them to get more gas flow through them, because otherwise they chip apart and they break.
Yeah.
So there's nothing you can do in terms of porting and polishing on those engines. Whereas a 3.8 RSR engine doesn't have any ceramic coating, so it's like what's called. So if you wanted to do a bit more work on them, you probably could, but you wouldn't need to, because when we open it up, like the valves are the size of plungers. They're huge. You know? So I'm raring to get that engine back in that shell.
Yeah.
And get that experience. But yeah, that'll be interesting to see what that puts out.
Sounds any dead sound deadening in that?
Yeah, no, because it's a race car. It's an RSR. There's no soundproofing. There's nothing.
So that would take some ear defenders with you.
Yeah. Well, I've done it with a race car before. Come to think of it, you're making me think, actually, I don't know whether I'd want to do it.
Well, no, you could. It's just...
I'm getting too old. I've done it with a race car before, and I was just, you know, I was in pieces by the end of it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it would be awesome, but I'm...
I don't know. I mean, you've got the pick of the bunch, right? So I think for me, it's got to be Black Betty. If that's being designed for that trip, you know, it's heart, soul, everything on the line to get that car back together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people are kind enough to ask me, you know, what should I do to my car? What modifications should I make and this and the other?
Yeah.
And I often say, actually, you're asking the wrong question. The question you need to ask yourself, not me or anyone else, is how you're going to use the car. And that defines everything.
Yeah.
It defines exactly how the car is built. And therefore, you have one succinct vision and a cohesive package that just works for that purpose.
Yeah.
If you build a car that's half track car, half, you know, this weekend warrior, half this and the other, it's just not being a master of
everything, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
and you were very kind, actually, with talking about the Cayman and saying something similar about that. The fact
absolutely.
The cohesive package as opposed to, you know, a load of bits thrown at something that kind of doesn't really achieve
Well,
anything.
Your car is, it's clear that you spend a lot of time really thinking about it, you know, not just going gung-ho and sticking shiny bits on it. It's clear that you've got a very clear vision of what you want to do, and it's a very cohesive package. That's what I was saying to you. I'm sure that if you marketed it as a product for people to, you know, to buy, you know, a Rengineering Cayman, I'm sure would come on quite the premium.
All of these decisions, even including to try and wrap it back up to road trips, let your heart rule your head. You know, if you sit to your point right at the start, if you sit there going, yeah, I'll do a road trip. I think that's a good thing to do. Maybe one day.
That's the line. One day.
It just doesn't happen.
One day, just puts it on the shelf, you know, over there.
Yeah.
If you go, okay, 2027. Now give yourself time. 2027.
Yeah.
That's the day I'm going to do it. What are the steps I need to get there? That's That's how you get it done.
Yeah,
for sure.
And even, and you know, let's face it, right? Some people will be watching this or listening to this and they've got families and they've got commitments. And actually it's quite difficult to negotiate some of those opportunities where you're prioritizing your own needs versus the needs of your family. And actually maybe that's the thing, is it looking far enough in advance and getting that agreement in place that you're not going to suddenly upset half a dozen people around you that rely on you because you've, you know, been selfish. But actually, it's about kind of, having that agreement and it being a feasible thing to do. And you'll enjoy it so much more, you know, if you know that it's something you've got, it's something, you know, that thing that you're going to do in 2027.
It's very hard to work endlessly not knowing where you're going.
Mm.
If you've got a goal, if you're working towards something and you feel like you're getting somewhere,
yeah,
you know, it's not just like you're just, it's just this endless black hole that disappears into nowhere. So I think if you can set a goal for whatever it is you want to achieve in life, work-wise, life-wise, car-wise, road trip-wise, whatever, then you've got direction, you've got flow, you know what you're doing. I think it works anyway, it's healthy for me.
Totally.
Yeah.
On that note, thank you so much for watching. I hope this, I don't know, what do you call it? A bit of everything, really. A kind of a classic waffle, but with me and Frank. So thank you so much for watching. You know where all the episodes are. They're on all podcast streaming services and on YouTube. And make sure you subscribe and like, and we'll see you next time. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Oh, and just to say on my side, you know, dude, thank you so much for having me on again. You know, I really appreciated the first time. It was great. Having you on Niners Unplugged has been fantastic. And I appreciate you being kind enough to want to have a look inside whatever's going on in my head.
No,
once again,
all, mate.
So thank you.
I think it goes back to that same thing. You know, you pick people or you kind of gravitate towards people that are kind of similarly minded, and then you just want to hang out with them and chat shit. And, you know, and it's part of that. I'm lucky that by doing this, there's, I'm on, what, 60 episodes now banked? And
gosh,
I think it's probably about half a dozen people out of those episodes that I've been like, yeah, you're one of my people. So I'll definitely be, you know, irrespective of whether it's been an episode shot or just hanging out, I'd be down for that. So it's not a challenge, mate, put it that way.
Yeah.
Thanks,
sure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Again, I left the sort of the bit that would probably have been after the outro in the episode, because it's just a reflection really on the relationship that Frank and I have, and I'm very grateful for the friendship we have now. But actually, it's just testament also to the community and the culture within the Porsche group and the Porsche community as well, and beyond, as Frank was saying. So I hope you're all doing well. Thank you so much for the support. The last episode that went out, the live episode at Porsche Club Great Britain on sort of modifying Caymans, I mean, that's been, for me, absolutely brilliant. Loads and loads of comments on YouTube, loads of great feedback. It's got a 97.8% like hit rate as well, so again, that's a pretty good thing when you're sort of in YouTube land. Can be quite the critique of the place, so especially when it's flooded with content, you get everything from, you know, Matt Armstrong doing 2 million views in about 15 minutes, all the way through to someone putting their first ever YouTube video up. And I think back actually to the first one I ever put up, and I've still left it up just as a marker really as to how far I've come. Where I was talking to Sam Fain from Seen Through Glass, and I overexposed the whole thing. You know, I you could tell that there was a little bit of skill in there, I think, but it was pretty horrendous, the video. But again, you know, it's important to leave some of this stuff in there, because you really get to see the progress. And actually, from those days where, you know, I really overthought a 2-minute chat with somebody to a live event where I was effectively the presenter for a live event with 40 odd people knocking around, it just goes to show in that few years how far things have come. So I want to extend my thanks out to you if you've been listening the entire time, if you're an OG and you've been around since the start and you've persevered. Persevered with the gaps, persevered with the highs and lows, but yeah, constantly show me support and show me the podcast support. That means an enormous amount. So thank you so much. If you're more recent and you've just started listening as a result of some of these bigger episodes that have happened, then thank you as well. I hope you stick around and listen to many more, and I'll see you next time. Make sure you get out and drive. There's some absolutely epic weather coming, and I'll see you at one of those shows soon. Take care for now. Bye-bye.